Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Come on, show me the magic.
Can I take you out to the pictures?
Well, I hope you'll come and see me in the movies.
What a scene
of your Hollywood song.
Hello, and welcome to the Beatles Films Podcast. I'm Matt Looker.
I'm Ed Williamson.
We're both professional film writers and Fab Four fans, and each week we discuss a different movie about, starring, or inspired by the Beatles. This week, that film is a 2008 feature-length documentary that chronicles the creation and development of Cirque du Soleil's Beatles-themed show, Love. The film, which went on to win a Grammy for Best Long-Form Music Video, perhaps raising questions about the need for a possible rename there, is essentially an extra-long making-of feature. It shows us the creatives behind the project making Love into a mind-bending concept, the acrobats making Love into a spectacular performance, and George and Giles Martin making Love into a double Grammy-winning concept album. And yet somehow the film avoided all the obvious puns and was simply called All Together Now. But first things first, Love as an album is absolutely brilliant, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Everyone seems to like it, right? I think it's the kind of thing that at the time people would have thought, oh God, right? Oh, they're changing it. They're going to meddle with it. And there is a lot in this film, actually. Especially George Martin in this is very, very aware of that. Giles as well, you know, they're both aware of the fact that if doing this and getting this wrong is potentially catastrophic. You know,
yeah, it's funny because you can't imagine that now, isn't it? Because it seems now so well received, and also just the idea of anybody saying, "Oh, messing with the Beatles recordings," when what you're doing by messing with them is making more Beatles recordings out of the originals.
Yeah.
It just seems churlish.
Yeah, you know? It does, yeah.
It seems crazy to me that anyone would have a problem with it, but this album I absolutely love, and I think that I probably turn to this album more. This might be sacrilege me saying this, but I probably turn to this album more for casual Beatles listening than any other album of theirs.
Right.
You know, because I think you go through phases, don't you? It's like, oh, I want to listen to early Beatles or you choose particular albums to listen to. But because Love covers the whole career in an interesting way, probably it's more my go-to than any particular one album.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. I listen to it a lot as well. And it's probably when in a similar mood, like, oh, I can't choose. I'll stick that one on, you know.
Yeah.
I think you do still get people today, you know, with the release of the remasters, 50th anniversary ones. You do still see people on social media saying, well, I've got the originals and I'm not interested in anything beyond that, which is completely fair enough. There's nothing wrong with that. And I mean, for me, honestly, like my ear is not so well attuned that I can always tell the difference, or I can immediately tell the difference. Some you definitely can. But I think for this was the first thing where they were deliberately trying to do it in such a way, because they were building this theatre in Las Vegas for the show, which involved having speakers in every chair. So the idea was there's a kind of surround sound element to it. So George and Giles are deliberately editing it in such a way that it's suitable for that.
Yeah.
And I think one of them says, I think maybe it's Giles says, you know, we're trying to do it in a way that it's as if you're sitting in the room with the Beatles playing around you. Yeah, I'd really like to see it, you know.
I know, yeah. And we should probably say up front, we're going to be talking about a feature-length documentary about a show we haven't seen.
Yeah, that's so true, yeah.
Let's see how far that gets us.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good point, actually, about how that was mixed for that immersive experience in mind, because I don't know whether this is a result of that, or just the nature of the project, but I do feel like whenever I listen to the album, I'm always finding things that I swear I've never heard before in there.
Yeah,
like I listened to it earlier, you know, early this week, and I think under the first verse in Glass Onion, it plays the end of the piccolo trumpet solo in Penny Lane.
Yeah.
And it's not hidden, it's not buried at all. It's just because there's so much going on in a lot of those songs, your attention gets diverted to one track or the other. Yeah. And I just don't remember noticing that before. And it's just, I just feel like it's, you know, sort of like a treasure trove of Easter eggs before that was even really a thing, to be able to like listen to that and just pick out elements and bits of guitar solo that you know it's from a track, and probably can't even pinpoint which track it is, but you just, you know, just that sort of the fun in recognizing those elements is just, yeah, it's great.
Yeah. And some bits even have bits where that are not in themselves all that distinctive. Yeah, I only recently realized, I think it's again Glass Onion has some of the acoustic guitars from Things We Said Today on it.
That's right, yeah.
Which actually makes perfect sense in terms of like the rhythm of those two songs. And even the key, actually, they're both in A minor, maybe. Those guitars are not particularly distinctive. But then once you know it's in there, you listen and it's completely obvious and you can't unhear it, you know. There are bits. I remember the first time I heard it thinking, what is it? Drive My Car then has the guitar solo from Taxman on it, I think.
Yeah, which is great.
And that works so well.
Yeah.
And even brings in, like, one of the sort of lesser, if you like, songs off Rubber Soul into that mix, which is...
You've got the word.
What You're Doing?
What You're Doing.
Which is great, you know, and it's nice for those songs to get a bit of an airing as well, you know.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And I my favourite part, I think, on the whole album is the break in Being for the Benefit of Mr. Kite into I Want You, She's So Heavy. And I think that was the first time I realised that, because you've got the, you know, Henry Horse dancing the waltz. It's the first time I realised that that ending to I Want You, She's So Heavy is also in the same time signature as a waltz. You know, it's in 3/4.
Yeah.
And it's just a brilliant segue into that. I feel like the whole project is such an interesting... It's a fun listen, but it's such an interesting showcase of how you can find suitable, relatable elements in different songs that span years and bring them together. It's actually brilliant. I'm basically describing the concept of a mashup, but but it works. It's a really good album. It's very fun.
Yeah, it does. I think like maybe my favourite bit from the album is the bit where at the end of there's the isolated vocals to Sun King backwards. Which then sort of finishes, and there's a couple of seconds of silence, and then you just get sort of George begins to sing Something, which is kind of unadorned until the rest of the music is faded up, and it's lovely. It's as if you've just sort of walked out into a clearing or something like that, and it's completely silent, and then it just sort of comes along. It's lovely. I just think the way you get the impression they were thinking a lot about sort of sound. Scapes, if I could use that.
Yep.
I can't really define what the term soundscapes means, but you know
what
I mean.
Right. Yeah.
It does sound right. It sounds like the kind of thing they probably would have been doing. They were thinking about ways in which the sound would have a specific effect, and not just which songs go well with which songs. You know?
And I think, so following that, to discuss this actual film itself, I will admit, I was a little bit disappointed that the film didn't cover as much of the music and the development of the album as the show, because I realized that, you know, the Cirque du Soleil show is a collaboration between that company and the Beatles. I guess I was expecting a little bit more 50-50 between music and performance,
yeah.
But actually the film is, understandably, it's absolutely fine, but I guess I'm interested in how the music side comes together. There is a brilliant special feature on the DVD which delves into that for quite a long time as well. It's a good 20-30 minutes.
20 minutes, yeah.
And that's really interesting because you can see Giles Martin like fading and out different isolated tracks and literally calling out, I've got this bit from this song and this bit from this song and stuff, and that's really interesting. So I could have watched an entire hour of that, instead we have the documentary, which is about the bringing together rehearsals and premiering of the Cirque du Soleil performance.
Mm.
Did you find, like I did a little bit, that as interesting as it was, like it just kind of made me want to watch the show? Which obviously, understandably, it doesn't show much of, because that's what the live experience is for.
Right.
But it was almost, in some ways, a little bit of a frustrating watch, because I kept seeing glimpses of things that I wanted to see play out properly.
Mm.
But that's not what the film is for.
Yeah. So I suppose... So this is a film that it sort of introduces a bit of narrative jeopardy. It has a lot of in common with Get Back, actually, the way that it handles that, whereby... It's telling you a countdown at 300 days to premiere, you know, and so where things go wrong is they do a little bit, not very seriously, but you do see a little bit of backstage tension, if you like. So it is kind of it is sort of driving it forward by giving you that thing of you know, here is we've only got this much time to put on a show, like it has to be done by this time, you know. It's sort of what it's trying to do. In doing so, you see snippets of rehearsal, and there are bits where they say, oh, there's a big bit in the middle of the stage that sort of collapses, and then a piano comes out of it or something like that, and you think, ah, okay, right, this will be the big thing where, like, you know, the shark in Jaws keeps on, the mechanical shark keeps on failing, and that whole thing. And it's not really, like, it's just sort of fixed, but it's sort of fixed pretty quickly. But also you don't really see the jeopardy of that. You don't see the sort of little conflicts and resolution that maybe it's supposed to indicate.
I completely agree. And I think it starts off really early on, saying 300 days to premiere.
Yeah.
And then you see later on 200 days to premiere. You don't really get a sense of how much progress has been made at that point. We're just watching some rehearsals to that point. And then it says, I think it says something like 131 days to premiere.
Mm.
And normally that kind of register, that time register, is so that we get the sense that when something goes really wrong, it's like, oh God, you've only got 131 days to go. How are you going to solve this in time? Like the entire stage needs rewiring, or like the prop master has read 7 feet instead of 7 inches, you know, or whatever it is. You know? But it's not. So the only reason why that says 131 days till premiere is because that's the day the camera crew turned up.
Yeah.
And that's what they're doing. Because actually what we're seeing is no different to 130 days till premiere, or, you know, 120 days, you know. I kind of got the impression that we were supposed to get the sense of this looming deadline that everything needs to fall into place for, and how are they going to pull it off. Yeah. But actually it seemed pretty much in hand.
Yeah, pretty much. I think, you know, this is a promotional film to go along with the show and the album. So while it's a perfectly entertaining film, I'm not sure anyone has particularly put a lot of thought into how are we going to structure this documentary, that kind of thing. You do get bits where the main guy, who the writer-director...
Dominic Champagne.
It is. We're recording this a couple of days after Martin Amis died, and it's quite nice to have a person who like could have been the name of a Martin Amis character. as if Martin Amis was writing a sort of louche playboy, like it's exactly what he'd be called. But this Dominic Champagne is not like that at all. He talks a bit. So you're told that, oh, this is the guy and he's written the story. And so, like, we don't really see what the story is. And that's kind of okay, I suppose, like they're deliberately hiding it from you because they're trying not to give too much away.
Yeah.
But also it's quite unsatisfying because you're not really told, you don't really see, oh, this is his creative vision, this is what he's trying to do. What you mainly see is him sort of having meetings with George and Giles and with Yoko and Olivia and various people and sort of trying to sort of sort out little bits, just like sort of firefight small bits of it. And actually what you're not seeing is like, oh, this guy wrote this thing. What's it about? What's the main gist?
And also because the bits that we see on stage, some of it looks incredible. Like some absolutely amazing visuals. The kind of thing where you look at it and it's B-roll footage, right, of the dress rehearsal or whatever it is, and you look at it and go, how have they pulled that off? That looks amazing. And there's not much explanation for those conceptual ideas that make up this performance. So you're right, what you're left with is this impression of Dominic Champagne, louche playboy Dominic Champagne, as kind of the guy who's just facilitating the work. And
yes,
there were lots of conversations where and it's actually really interesting seeing him address the fact that he has a delicate balance to maintain between his stakeholders, which are the various members of the Beatles estate. And actually it's not explicitly stated, but I think when you watch the film, it's clear that there have had to be some compromises made as a result of trying to maintain a delicate balance and keep everyone happy. But again, that just sort of reduces him to the role of facilitator and mitigator. You know, which is a shame, really, because he's clearly a creative visionary.
There's interesting bits in it where Olivia and Yoko, I think Olivia probably more than Yoko, but Olivia Harrison in particular seems to have a fair bit of creative involvement in this. I think it's largely because the project sort of initially came about because of George Harrison's friendship with Guy Laliberté, who's one of the founders of Cirque du Soleil. I think they met on the Formula One circuit or something
can call it a circuit when it's any other industry, but a Formula One circuit feels like they've met on the track.
Or just running around it. Hi, how's it going? You running as well? Oh, yeah. Anyway, what do you do? Oh, I'm in the circus.
I've got a business proposition for you.
And so I think because of that, George having... he was a big fan of the whole thing of Cirque du Soleil, and him having sort of at least kicked off the idea of the project. I think Olivia is involved now, sort of after his death, and she had. I think they're all it's slightly unspoken, but they're all kind of doing it for George in a way, and they want to fulfil his vision. Olivia's very committed to that, and so there are scenes in which she's giving feedback. But these are some of the moments of actual real tension in this film where you think, oh wow, you're actually showing this, because she gives a bit of feedback about a couple of the characters and says, listen, if I can speak freely, I don't like these characters at all. And it seems from the context that she's talking about like two characters who are quite fundamental to the entire thing. And this feedback is coming quite late in the day, it seems.
And elsewhere in the documentary, she talks about the creative choice by George and Giles to use an acoustic demo version of While My Guitar Gently Weeps. She explicitly says everyone wanted this version of the song but me, because she said she didn't see how a demo version of that song would work in a big theatre. And I am left thinking, there were teams of people working on this project who are more than capable of knowing whether or not that is possible to work or not. Appreciate her stance on this is to honour George's input and his art in that way. But it feels like, I don't know, Olivia saying that and putting her foot down a little bit about that choice, it feels like, that's why you have other creative teams who are experts in this particular area. And then actually the way they get around that, I think, the film explains is that George Martin then writes what is what becomes his last string arrangement ever, let alone for a Beatles song, and that gives it a bit more of a lush feel that fills the theatre. So it's a welcome choice or welcome solution to that concern.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's feedback from Olivia that's voiced in a couple of instances in the film that feels like it brings about tension. Hmm. Also, there's Yoko Ono, who at some point calls out that the performance that happens during Come Together is too sleazy, and that the song itself is more about a coming together for political activism. And that really seems to grind Dominic Champagne's gears.
he
seems particularly stressed about that. He has like this it's like a paper lever arch folder paper
bulldog clip,
and you just see that like him pinching his hands with it, almost like it's like out of frustration and tension.
That's throughout the film, isn't it? The cameraman has obviously noticed that he does this, and every now and again we'll focus in on it, which is
quite fun.
Very good camera work. It's funny, like, you know, so you have Olivia and Yoko, absolutely it's right and proper that their voices should be heard in these things, you know. But I don't know, I suppose this is one of the things that, you know, I think there's always a bit of sexism about, I don't mean in terms of Dominic Champagne, despite the name, I don't think he's a sexist at all. I think in general, the way that people think about this, there has always been a little bit of an undertone. It's like, well, what do these women know? This is men's rock. Like, how dare they, you know? And like, I am against that. However, both of the things they're saying there, I mean, I disagree with Yoko Ono. I think Come Together is a deeply sleazy song, and all the better for it.
Right? Yes,
it's part of its charm. And yes, the sort of, I get that there are. I think he originally wrote it as Timothy Leary's campaign song to run for governor of California, right? Yeah. So, but I mean, I don't think that, you know, Here Come Old Flat Top is a particularly political line, you know. And like with Olivia's thoughts about While My Guitar Gently Weeps, I found that really interesting because I wonder whether she felt nervous that George's voice would be too sort of unadorned and a bit too... She would have been aware, certainly, of... Not in the Beatles years so much, but like sort of later on, you could sort of tell George's vocal frailty in places, especially in the 70s when he was sort of doing too much cocaine, and also... on Brainwashed, the posthumous album, bits of which were recorded, you know, when he had cancer, and you can hear the frailty, and it was actually one of the things that gives that album its charm, as far as I'm concerned, and some the sort of vulnerability you can hear. But I wonder whether she was a bit concerned about just having George's voice up there on its own, you know.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I mean, I have never particularly liked the studio version of While My Guitar Gently Weeps. I've always preferred that demo version anyway. You
know? Yeah, that is interesting. I think the point isn't that their concerns aren't valid. I think the point is that, as the documentary shows, it feels like when those concerns are raised, it's a bit late in the day. We've written an entire production around these two characters.
Yeah.
And Come Together, like, I get the impression, at least when that comes up in the film, that there have been lots and lots of rehearsals of that song to that music before Yoko makes the comment that it shouldn't be that sleazy.
Mm.
The elegant solution they seem to come up with for that, and this is probably unfair because I obviously haven't seen the whole show and the context of this performance, but when we see it later on in the film, we see the exact same quote-unquote sleazy dance routine, but on the screens in the backdrop, there were some videos of people marching.
Yep.
So there we go. Political activism and sleaziness in one, just as John wanted.
Exactly.
One of the interesting things that happens as a result of those moments in the film is that you really see Dominic Champagne's chagrin.
Yes.
At having to face these comments and these criticisms, I guess, and the pressure that puts him under to then change elements of the show. And you see actual backstage drama, actual arguments at the back of that. And I find that interesting because there's always something very titillating about watching something like that play out, isn't there? You know that you're having access to scenes that really shouldn't be made public, because this is about the private creative process. and you get to see this sort of this drama play out a little bit backstage, which is quite interesting to see.
Yeah, that's always interesting. That's obviously one of the big appeals of Get Back, in that, you know, they of course are aware they're being filmed, but no one can get, a bit like watching Big Brother, like no one can keep up the awareness that they're being filmed 24 hours a day. So, you know, a lot of what you get is quite natural interactions. Obviously, one of the, it's probably the most controversial segment of Get Back is the sort of hidden microphone in the flower pot thing.
And he's
recording John and Paul having their conversation. And yeah, so you get bits of that sort of thing here where you feel like you're getting a little peek behind the curtain. Remember George saying in the anthology about bringing Eric Clapton in the White Album sessions to play on While My Guitar Gently Weeps, and he said, oh, it's interesting how people are always on their best behaviour when a guest turns up, you know.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
All the arguments stop for a while. But yeah, there does seem to be a bit, there's kind of always tension, you know, in the sort of post-Beatles. I thought it was quite nice to see that Olivia and Yoko seem to be quite close and seem to quite like each other, and are certainly, when they're there together, do seem to be working as a unit, you know.
Yes, you're right. Yeah.
On behalf of...
And supportive of each other and each other's comments as well. They're backing each other up a lot.
And they're not trying to... I mean, George Martin makes the really good points in it, that all of them individually, Paul, Ringo, Yoko and Olivia, are all sort of fighting their own corner, for their individual Beatle, you know.
He makes that brilliant analogy where he says it's like looking at a school photo, and the first thing you do when you look at a school photo is look for yourself.
Yeah.
First. And I think that's brilliant. It's such a good comparison to make.
It's completely true. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, so that tension has always been there a bit, you know. One of the things I found really interesting, actually, is that at the start of this, when they talk about the way the project was initiated, so we know that it comes from George and his fondness for Cirque du Soleil. And then Paul, in his first sort of talking head bit, says, well, I first saw Cirque du Soleil when my daughter took me to see it at the Royal Albert Hall. And then George and Olivia took me to see O in Las Vegas. So O is another Cirque du Soleil show that's been running in Las Vegas forever, I think. Mm. And so he's talking about that happening in 2001. So early 2001, this would have been perhaps before he knew he had cancer again. I'm not really sure of the timeline of it. And so, yeah, he says, yeah, George and Olivia took me to see this show. And I thought, really? Like, Paul and George were certainly on much better terms, certainly by the end of his life. But I was quite surprised to hear that George would be like, oh, this is a really good show. I'm going to ring up Paul and see if he wants to come to this. And I thought, well, maybe Paul is kind of exaggerating the way that happened. But then you see a still photograph of Paul and George backstage at that show with the cast.
Yeah.
They just seem to be having a great time and both seem to be very happy. And I thought, well, that's lovely.
Yeah.
I had no idea that was the case.
It's interesting, really, isn't it? Nice. Because I wonder, like, so I guess two things about that. One is just that, my understanding of that whole period and the relationship between Paul and George at that time is that during the making of the anthology series, they didn't really get along. They had to put on a bit of a show for appearances' sake.
Yeah.
And that is quite obvious and palpable in the footage you see of them reuniting in that series.
Yep.
And then sort of skip ahead a number of years and you have Paul's very tender story about how he held George's hand whilst he was essentially on his deathbed. Mm-hmm. And I've always kind of had a bit of a disconnect there in terms of, like, you know, how did that sort of reconciliation come about if there was tension in anthology? And I think there's probably a danger. One, there's a danger of assuming that that narrative around your anthology is the only narrative that exists.
Mm.
And I think, you know, we are always in a habit of simplifying things in that way. But the other thing as well is that, is there something in the fact that George taking Paul to O was actually a way to kickstart some of the conversations about this project?
Yeah.
You know, maybe that was a precursor for that, which obviously he'd need Paul's sign off to progress on that. So maybe that was part of that reconciliation.
Yeah, quite possibly. I don't know. I suppose this thing is that maybe we have the tendency because, you know, all we know is the sort of big steps in this story, you know. So we think, oh, well, they hated each other in the anthology and then they seem to love each other in 2001, you know. And that, but of course, I mean, there's so many little meetings and dinners and phone calls and things like that in between that, some of which will have gone well and some of which will have gone badly.
Yeah.
But, and so I suppose you end up thinking, you know, the reason I immediately think, oh, that's weird, I wouldn't have thought they would have gone to a show together, it's completely based on my only knowing the bit, you know, being aware of the public meetings they had, or the meetings that were witnessed and people have written about.
Yeah.
And of course, there were so many other ones that I wouldn't know about. You know,
and also, all of their conversations would have been predicated on the fact that they are friends and business colleagues, both at the same time. And depending on what, you know, which one of those things they were about, then you know, that's going to determine whether it goes good or bad, I guess. You know,
what's
going to contribute to it.
Yeah, so many little interactions they would have had. Like every time there's some new Beatles product coming out, like a remaster of an album or a re-release of this or that or whatever, or, you know, some box set of something, there will have been a bit, you know, even if they weren't in touch, you know, sort of all the time, week to week, they would have been getting together to discuss those.
Yes.
And all of these are little interactions where, you know, I suppose their relationship could be, you know, getting a little bit better every time if it goes, even if it's a 5-minute phone call, but it goes well.
Yeah,
know,
exactly.
Like, and also, of course, like these men have known each other since they were sort of, you know, 14 years old or whatever it is.
Hmm.
There's such an enormous amount of history and closeness between them that whatever their disagreements, you know, but it's obviously just a sort of abiding love and respect between the two of them. It would be, and so whenever I see evidence that they sort of got together and have fun, it shouldn't be such a surprise to me.
Yes, know? Yeah, like, yeah, of course. You know. If anything, it makes you wonder how many other things happened that you wish you knew about.
Oh, but just so remained
private. Yeah,
so
exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Going back to what we were saying before about the tensions that we see come through in this documentary, one of the things why that's quite interesting is because, and we've talked about this before, is that even though this is part of an official Apple project, an official Beatles project, and even though this film is obviously an official product from Apple, you don't actually expect to see that sort of behind-the-scenes tension nowadays.
Yeah.
You know, that all gets polished out now. And, you know, like I say, we have talked about this before many times, but that's why it's so interesting that when this DVD was released, which was 2008... there was still an opportunity for us to really see a little bit, you know, what's really under the bonnet of Apple Corps and those sort of business relationships and existing friendships.
Yeah, they seems to be one of the last things that sort of Apple released before they really turned into Apple 2.0, you know, and really got to grips with this is the Beatles' legacy and this is our plan to keep it going with, you know, with various media releases, which now is just it's just an absolute juggernaut, and they have planned it exceptionally well.
Is that because of Neil Aspinall passing?
I don't know. I mean, I suppose it's, I mean, those things do seem to have coincided in a way, but I mean, but Neil's certainly like an excellent steward of the Beatles' legacy, and he's This film, by the way, is dedicated to his memory because he died around this time. And so he's one of the talking heads in it. And he's sort of one of the executive producers of the show. And he talks in it about that previously Cirque du Soleil shows had always featured performed music. And that was the proposal with which they came to him, that this will be performers playing Beatles songs. And he immediately said, no, it has to be the actual recordings.
Yeah.
And he's 100% right about that. You know, there's no magic in this thing if it's other people playing it.
Yeah.
Playing the song.
It feels like there's no magic in this thing without the particular album that we get, which is an immersive Beatles experience. Like, I imagine that the idea behind having performers play those songs would be they'd be played much straighter. Because you don't have the opportunity to play with the different elements of the songs that we eventually get.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the thought of having sort of acrobats perform to just a covers band, which is essentially what that would be, doesn't feel anywhere near as exciting.
No. But, you know, Neil completely understood how special the Beatles are, and he was very protective of that legacy, and he did an absolutely fantastic job as well. I think this is... interesting thing about this being an official Apple product is that I'm surprised that as a documentary it's not more well known, because although the subject matter is sort of fairly niche, arguably, i.e. this one show that Cirque du Soleil did, and it's about how that show was put together, which nobody is particularly fascinated about, I suppose. But also, this is an official Apple product. It has actual contemporary talking head contributions from Paul, Ringo, Yoko, Olivia, Neil Aspinall, George Martin, Giles Martin. Who else? But that'll do.
From the Beatles camp, I don't think there's anyone else. But obviously then you have the Cirque du Soleil.
Yeah, so yeah. But in terms of, you know, actual proper heavyweights in, you know, we talk a lot when we talk about these documentaries about the sort of quality of talking heads they've got in there. And this is pretty much unparalleled, other than the anthology and things. And so it's interesting that it's less well known about as a document, and also that it's just like a DVD they released in 2008, and then that's kind of it.
Yeah, it does feel like, even though the album won a couple of Grammys, and this DVD won the Grammy for best long form music video. I really don't know how that works.
Yeah.
It kind of does feel a little bit like this was a coincidental DVD release just to help prop up the actual bigger Love show and album event.
Yeah.
Even though it came out a couple of years later.
Yeah.
It feels like that's really what it's there to do, is just to add an extra element that contributes to this overall like phenomenon, which is the project.
Yeah, I think it may have also been released in a box with the CD of the Love album. I think there's a bit on the Wikipedia page I was reading about, like, about the album, that says that it gives sort of different lengths for different versions of the album, and there's vinyl and there's CD and there's DVD, and they all have slightly different lengths. So I think it must have been packaged.
Okay, I have no idea how that works. Then, if it won the Grammy in 2009, but it was actually released 3 years earlier, you're probably right. It's probably been repackaged differently. But
I have no idea. But
one of the things, though, that we do get as a result of these talking heads is a bit of a run through of some very familiar anecdotes, I don't think we should really mind that too much. One of the reasons why they are familiar anecdotes is because we know that, you know, they've been run out a lot over the course of lots of documentaries. So it's unfair of us to call that out every single time as being like, oh, we're telling that one again. You know, that's kind of why they are familiar in the first place. I think what is interesting about them is that some of them don't feel like they're really relevant to the objective of that DVD.
Yeah.
You know, when you have Paul talking about his relationship with George Martin, as in him being the grown-up and the Beatles being the kids, when George talks about John Lennon once said to him that he wanted to re-record all the Beatles songs, especially Strawberry Fields, for, you know, that story. And you have to wonder, one of these story is doing in service of promoting the Cirque du Soleil show.
Yeah.
You know, it feels like they're there just to, I guess, capture context, but context that might necessarily be relevant to the overall picture that this film is dedicated to showing us.
Yeah. Yeah, I wonder how much of it is that the questions that have been asked is there must be a bit of general, just sort of more general questioning that is not about the Cirque du Soleil show. So if you think about Ringo's involvement, so Ringo's a talking head in this documentary, goes so far as to wear the official Beatles Love Cirque du Soleil t-shirt.
And I love this album dearly.
Yeah.
But watching Ringo wear it as a t-shirt makes you realise how ugly it works as a wearable. You know, it's that sleeve, the album sleeve that Ringo wears on his chest that clashes horribly with the bright red sleeves of his denim jacket or whatever it is else that he's wearing. Just, yeah, it's a very strange look.
Yeah, I wonder if maybe he just wears it now if he's doing gardening or like painting spare room or something like that.
Exactly.
You know, just like...
it's the kind of sleeve that will cover up a lot of spillages. So.
Yeah, yeah. You end up with a lot of promotional tats when you're in show business. Just people give you gift bags of things, you know, so that's what it ends up doing. Like being the towel that you keep in the car to like to dry off the dog when it's jumped in a puddle, you know, that kind of thing. Anyway. So Ringo is in this, and Ringo's involvement in the actual Cirque du Soleil project seems to have not been all that much. He has definitely been in the room and sort of approved bits of it. He's definitely approved the concept. And sort of Giles played him the Octopus's Garden mix that's in there, and he approves that, and he has suggestions on it, you know. So he's contributing, but I don't think he is as involved as he's a bit less involved than Paul, who is in turn a bit less involved than Olivia, I would say.
Yeah.
So when they're interviewing Ringo for this, there's probably only so much they can get out of him just by saying, "What do you think of the Cirque du Soleil thing?" Because you know, and you see him, so you know, he thinks it's really good. And probably the rest of it is that, you know, they're going to need a bit more color. So they are asking him things like, you know, how do you? I think they must have asked him like, "Or how did you join the Beatles?" or something like that.
Yeah,
right?
Sure.
Because he does appear to be answering something along those lines. But this is the thing that with a lot of these things, that by accident, nice things come out of it. Because he says, "I just love the front line of that band. John, Paul and George, they were the front line of that band and they were writing the best songs ever." And that in itself, it's a lovely thing to say. Like, Ringo was always full of lovely compliments in these documentaries because he just absolutely loved being in that band. And you suspect never wanted it to end, you know, and wished it had just gone on forever. You know? But also, the first time I've ever heard him, he doesn't say it per se, but almost describing himself as a sideman to the whole thing.
Yeah.
You know, like, yeah. Which I don't think he was, but I mean, it's a thing that he's most accused of being sort of lucky to be there or whatever, which is rubbish. But that's kind of the way he frames it, you know, that was the front line of that band. You know,
I just thought it was a nice turn of phrase and a nice way of describing the other three members of the band when you're the drummer.
Yeah.
It's a neat way of sort of singling out yourself as being not at the same level physically, not artistically.
Yeah.
I don't think he's making that point. I think he's saying he got to sit behind the drum kit and stare at the front line of the band when they were a band together.
Right.
And he loved them. And he loved that. I thought it was just a nice way of collectively calling out, you know, John, George and Paul in a nice sort of neat phrase, which I don't think Paul would be able to do about the other three Beatles. You know, how would you collectively refer to them?
Yeah, true. Yeah, yeah. No, perhaps not. You're right.
You mentioned before about Octopus's Garden. I can't remember. I think that might have come from the music-focused special feature. When Giles Martin talks about how nervous he was to work on Octopus's Garden because Ringo kept saying, "That's my big number. Like, don't mess it up."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that kind of thing is the thing that I would have wanted more in the main feature.
Yeah.
But you're right. The reason why it's not is because it's Giles telling that story and they need to have Ringo time in the film.
Mm.
And Ringo isn't telling the story about the work that went into Octopus's Garden, because he didn't do that work.
No.
He's basically waiting for the phone call to come into the studio and hear it, and that's his story.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
And it was great. It was gear.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's what he always says about Sergeant Pepper, you know, it's for him, his memory of Sergeant Pepper is waiting around a lot.
Yeah.
And like, I think he said he learned to play chess and things like that in the studio, because everyone else was sort of getting on with stuff and then he'd come in and do his drums and that'd be that.
Well done. Yeah. The other interesting thing about all of that is Paul has a slightly different tack, I think, when he's talking about it. He's much more involved in the project. You can see him at some points in the special features, you see him visiting the theatre as it's being built, wearing a big hard hat with PM written on it.
Yes, I know. Yeah. It's great. And no, by the way, no one else's hat has their initials on it.
No, of course not. No. The only thing that's important is that no one else wears Paul's hat. Right. That's so why his has the initials. All the other hats are anybody's. It's a free-for-all.
Yeah.
But it's also just scrawled on in like marker pen, isn't it? PM.
Yeah. They're just otherwise identical hats. Like...
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, that was that
So Paul obviously has much more involvement. You see him visit the dress rehearsals more. He's an active member. He's an active member of the audience. He talks to the troupe and gives them encouragement after he sees some performance and stuff. And he talks to Dominic Champagne.
Yeah.
But I did find it really interesting, and tell me if you think this is unfair, but at one point Paul is talking about hearing what George and Giles have done to the music for the first time, which we're told a few times actually that as a showcase for what they want to do with the rest of the album, they put the Tomorrow Never Knows drums with Within Without You lead vocal over the top. So they played that to the group, and Giles talks about being nervous about that. When we hear Paul's side of that story, he starts off by saying, we told George and Giles to be as experimental as possible, and then they played us this track. And what you want Paul to say is, I was blown away, it was absolutely brilliant, they did a fantastic job, it was really inventive and creative, etc.
Yeah.
What he actually says is, that was exactly what we asked you to do. Well done, that is, you know, that's exactly it, that is the one, that's it.
Yeah.
And then he when he talks about some of the elements of the songs being put together into one track, he says, you know, you hear these different parts of the songs come together and they just work brilliantly together. And it's like, that's, again, it's still not crediting George and Giles for the work that you do. And actually we get the impression that Giles did most of that work and George was inputting different parts.
Yeah.
I think that's quite clear. But at no point does Paul really call out this significant undertaking and how absolutely brilliant the final product is. He kind of almost suggests that he deserves some of the credit for just telling them to be experimental in the first place.
Right. Yeah. In a way, it was my idea. I suggested we should be more you should be more experimental, and you were, and the results were good.
Yeah. And then the result is another great album that I've released.
Yeah, it does seem that way a bit. I do think, listen, I mean, we're kind of fairly seasoned McCartney watchers in terms of his documentary appearances now. And I think it's really interesting to watch the way that he has evolved as an interviewee over the years. You know, we've seen him in a few different guises now. And certainly the kind of stage he's at now, like McCartney 321, is probably the most sort of recent example where he's being interviewed at length in a documentary. You can check out our episode about that from last season. And I think he seems to have kind of nailed that. A persona is the wrong word. I don't think he's putting on a persona, but I think he is much more gracious in the credit that he gives to other people. And I don't mean to suggest that he never thought other people's input was not worth crediting, but I do think he's more self-aware now about the need to do that. And I think as he has got older, he is much more, he's a big Beatles fan now, you know, and he says this in this documentary at one point, or something similar. He says something along the lines of, you know, like while he and Ringo are sitting watching a dress rehearsal, I think he says, I kept on leaning over to Ringo and saying, we were effing great, weren't we? which is nice.
Yeah.
You know, and he says then in the Talking Heads thing, like, you know, I can say that now. You know, I feel that, you know, before, you know, I don't feel like I need to be humble about it. It's like, you know, we were great. And, you know, he's really proud of those achievements. So I think he actually seems to have got to a point at some point between this documentary and now-ish, whereby he just loves the fact that he was involved. He does say things these days along the lines of, like, every now and again, I just think, wow, I was in the Beatles. Like, you know, yeah. I think he says in this documentary, you know, there's only four people in the world who can say that, yeah. And I'm one of them. Which is kind of, and he isn't saying it in a I'm amazing kind of way. He's saying, like, isn't it amazing kind
yes.
of way.
Yeah, know? Yeah.
Almost as if, what an amazing coincidence that I happen to be one of the Beatles.
It's almost this is almost a little bit of a golden time for McCartney as an interviewee, possibly.
Mm.
Because I think you're right, we've covered some earlier projects where he's been a talking head or being interviewed, and he doesn't always come across well.
Yes.
And now he's much more self-aware, to the point where you could argue some of what he says feels a little bit sanitized,
yeah.
You know, a little bit too polished.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think in this, at this stage, when he mentions that and he says, you know, I four Beatles in the world, in the universe, and I was one of them, it does feel like it comes with genuine excitement. Like, he's not worried about how that comes across.
Mm.
And as a result, we understand that it's not him being immodest. It's it is an amazing thing to think about in those terms. So we're kind of on the same wavelength there. It's kind of probably a good balance, I think, on the whole. As much as what I said about him not giving Giles much credit for the huge amount of work that he did on the recordings.
Yeah.
The other thing as well we get on this is, there are lots of really lovely moments throughout the film. There's lots of lovely moments with Giles talking about working with his dad, George.
Yeah.
There's some lovely stuff you hear him say about his dad while his dad is in the room, and actually his dad, George, is focused on listening to, I think it's She's Leaving Home, and he's almost like following the string arrangement of his finger.
He's doing air cello, isn't
yes,
he?
Yes, yeah. But Giles is just talking about how nice it is working with him, and I think at one point he even says, like, that's the thing that he'll remember about this project, not the thing itself.
Yeah.
You know, which is just unbelievably lovely.
Yeah.
There's also, obviously, there's lots of lovely footage of Paul and Ringo sat together during the premiere, singing along, doing some air drums and and stuff like that, and you just feel like, oh, they're really into it, they're enjoying it,
yeah.
Which is great.
Yeah.
And I think one of my favourite moments in the whole film is Paul says to George, I think it's during the dress rehearsal, one of the early rehearsals, and he says, you know, the funny thing is, like, he remembers writing these songs, and I think the example he gives is, like, Eleanor Rigby. And he says, like, I remember writing this bit or the bit on the piano or some of the words, like, on the back of an envelope, and now it's this.
Yeah.
It's, like, indicating now it's this huge production.
Yeah.
He says, like, isn't that amazing? And just this idea of him realising the small memory of him doing something relatively insignificant to him now being realised in such a huge way.
Mm.
It's just a lovely sort of comparison to make.
Yeah, and there is also a humility in that, I think.
Yes.
In the way he describes that, you know, as a thought he's had, it's quite a humble one. But it is nice that, you know, there are bits where I'm sure they realise that they're mic'd up, but, like, they are just kind of sitting chatting to each other in the while they wait for the things to start, I think. And Paul is, there's some sort of old Beatles anecdote that he's telling to George.
Oh, he's talking about how, when they played a roundel, they had to, like, keep moving Ringo's drum kit around so they could play stuff with parts of the audience.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And it's funny because, like, presumably he has told George Martin this before, right? I mean, he's told everyone this before, really. But the two of them are absolutely lapping it up, you know. You know, they're just really enjoying each other's company. Actually, you know, there is a thing sometimes, just sort of meeting old friends who you haven't seen for a while but you have a history with. Sometimes it can be quite satisfying just to sort of go over things. You know, you've had the conversation before, but it's quite nice having it again.
Yeah, just relive, because that's the person you have those memories with, right?
Right,
you're
exactly.
Reliving those same experiences.
Yeah.
It does make me think, though, that for all of our criticisms of both Paul and George often reeling out the same anecdotes, they are well suited to each other then, you know, at that age where they can just sit next to each other and just reel off the same anecdotes to each other to their heart's content, both being perfectly happy to be both anecdota and anecdote-y. Yeah, it's like they're absolutely made for each other. The only thing that I'm sort of left thinking about whilst watching this film about the show and having not seen the show is I hadn't realised before that there are elements of the show that don't exist on the album. I guess I kind of just assumed that all audio of the show would be captured in this sort of neat package that I listen to, you know, several times on a regular basis.
Yeah.
But actually, the film shows us that there are sections within the show itself that focus on studio chatter between the band. Mm. And they have a neat sort of interplay on stage, it seems, where they are acting out as the Beatles in silhouette form, along with the recording of them chatting to each other and making jokes in the studio with each other. I'd love to hear that in full. I'd love to see it, obviously, in the show and see how that's played out as a show stuff. But I'd love to understand all of the bits that I am missing that are in the show that aren't present on the Love album.
Yeah, there was. I mean, there's always been a magic to their studio chatter. You know, every time you hear new Beatles studio chatter, it just really feels like a hidden gem.
Yeah.
And I don't know. And of course, there's a bias when you're a big fan, but also, but I really don't think that applies to other artists. Not really. You know, or maybe if you're a huge fan of any artist, then you get the same thing. But
you
I just can't
imagine the same sense of excitement that a Travis fan feels from some unearthed conversation that they've had in the studio between recording songs of their album.
No, right, exactly. And, you know, and all these little bits, when you hear them, just feel like a treasure trove. And I think because there was just a sort of a magic to their interplay, which is just as big a part of them as their music, in terms of in terms of the image that the world had of them and still has of them. Yeah, I think it actually it's such a good creative choice to include that in the show.
Yes, I agree. Yeah, to show their personality and have the personality become part of the show. It's their sense of humour, isn't it? That was so important to them as a band that I guess otherwise does go missing in that production, because all you're left with is the art.
Yeah,
And not their personality.
Yeah, yeah, and also, I mean, given what Paul was saying about, you know, the smallness of writing the song, imagine the smallness of literally just saying something when you've messed up a take, or you said, oh, you know, my guitar string's broken or something like that, or like, can we have a cup of tea, please, or something like that. And then that's part of, like, sort of, you know, 50 years later, that's part of an enormous Las Vegas extravaganza show, you know.
You do see that very, very briefly in the film, where you see him watching some of that studio chatter stuff play out, and he's got a really big smile on his face, because you do get the impression it's like that would be him reliving something from his 20s, just a random conversation captured in time and now played at large.
Yeah, crazy, right? You know, I mean, you can it's the sort of thing that might lead one to have a big ego, you know, where even the things, even just sort of casual utterances that you said to your friends sort of 50 years ago are now just incredibly prized as sort of cultural artifacts, you know. I mean, like the outtakes of this podcast are never going to be put into a compilation for people to enjoy. Like,
I've got something planned. I've got something planned. In all honesty, we're not going to be able to probably see and understand and enjoy all those different aspects of the show without just having to go and see the show. So I think we have to book a trip to Las Vegas. Or it would be remiss of us to not call this out as a potential solution to this problem. Maybe this is the thing that Peter Jackson's working on. Maybe this is what he's going to be bringing out, is a immersive film of the Cirque du Soleil show set to a remastered Love album.
Yep. It could be that. A remastered Love album. I think by all means, if he wanted to fly us out to Las Vegas to watch it and cover the whole thing, I think we'd be happy to discuss that.
But anyway, more importantly, What do you think, listeners? Would you like to see that as Peter Jackson's next project? Probably not. But what do you think of the Love album? We'd love to hear what you think. Does anybody actually think it is sacrilege to be messing around with those songs? I can't imagine that anybody feels that way, but we'd love to hear anybody who does think that's the case. Has anybody seen this documentary? And does anybody have any other thoughts that they'd like to share with us? You can reach us on all the usual social media platforms at Beatles Films Pod. You can also, if you're so inclined, leave us a 5-star rating or a review on your podcast listening platform of choice. Otherwise, we'll see you again next week for another episode. And until then, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.